Welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm your host, Larry Rutter. This week, we're going to meet a lot of interesting people doing very interesting and exciting things. For a start, we're going to talk to a group of lawyers who visited our area recently, dedicated to getting innocent people released from prison.
And it's pretty shocking that in a system that, first of all, is overcrowded and expensive, that we would have any interest in keeping innocent people in prison just to uphold procedures. So the governor's looking at decreasing the population, and what we want to say to him is, why don't we start with the innocent people?
Then we're going to get a sneak preview of the issues and concerns facing the city of San Luis Obispo as it plans for the year 2035.
If there's the school district has a property that's on Los Osos Valley Road that they're looking forward in the future, they won't need for a school any longer. So they're asking for some community help.
We'll also be entertained with a sneak preview of the next offering of the Pewter Plow Playhouse in Cambria.
This play is one of those murder mysteries that keep people guessing from start to finish, and every time they think they've got it figured out, it's like, what? Oh my gosh. Right down to the very last word of the show.
And then I think you'll get a chance to learn how the world of news and journalism and how it's taught in places like Cal Poly is adjusting to the brave new world of instant online media.
We're calling it digital first. It's not a term we invented. It's out there. It's really turning the whole thing upside down, where the first thing that's on your mind is, what are the digital tools available to you? What are the social tools available to you? What are the multimedia tools available to you that you can start to tell the story in what they call in real time as it's happening?
I think you'll find the next hour filled with variety information and some very interesting people. So stay with us. A group of people is walking from San Diego to Sacramento, and one of their stops is on the Cal Poly campus. And last week, they literally walked into San Luis Obispo for a talk on campus about their organization and their mission. And I kind of waylaid the group and invited them to the KCBX studios to talk about the organization and what they're seeking to achieve. The organization is the California Innocence Project. And with me in the studio is its director, Justin Brooks, and one of the staff attorneys, Elisa Biracle. Welcome, both of you, to the KCBX microphones.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Innocence Project, I think I have a general idea what that involves, but give me some specifics. What are you trying to do?
We're a law school clinic at California Western School of Law in San Diego, and we're devoted to getting innocent people out of prison. So it's a very simple concept. Inmates and their family members write to us. We investigate every case that we receive into our office, and we use law students, lawyers, and law professors to investigate the cases. And if we find strong evidence of innocence, we go to court, get those cases reopened, and hopefully get those people home to their families.
Why are you interested in that? I mean, as a lawyer, there's a lot more money and a lot more fame in the other side of the table. What interests you in that?
I mean, nothing could be more amazing than walking an innocent person out of prison. I've had the pleasure of doing that 10 times, and you get to give people their lives back. It's also amazing training for young lawyers. So we have every year a group of law students that we train to be lawyers while they're working on real cases. And the idea is to train them the way we train doctors. You know, doctors aren't just sent out to practice without ever working with human beings.
Interns.
So we take them, they kind of deconstruct the cases, figure out what went wrong, and then we piece them back together.
Now, Barry Scheck has a New York-based version of this, and he's probably had the more national exposure. But I guess it's not uncommon on a state basis to have an Innocence Project.
Yeah, we now have 50-some projects in the United States, and we have projects around the world. The most recent project is a project that we started in Mexico at UABC Law School in Tijuana. So we actually run a project out of the law school down there. The network of projects all work together year, we have a board that oversees all the projects. I sit on that board along with Barry Scheck. Mm-hmm. And this has become an international movement. And it's because it's very simple, and I think it's apolitical in the sense of we can all agree that innocent people shouldn't be in prison.
Mm-hmm. And there have been some phenomenal successes, both on the state level and the national level, of freeing people from prison.
Yeah, every one of them is a huge news story. We represented a kid last year called Brian Banks, and he just got signed by the Atlanta Falcons as a linebacker. And his was a huge news story, and it brought a lot of attention to our cause. And Alyssa here actually worked on that case.
Melissa Biracle is a staff attorney. Tell us about that case.
The Brian Banks case was a case that came to us kind of the same way a lot of cases come to us, through the person writing and saying, I'm innocent. And, you know, we take a look at every single one of these cases, and in Brian's case, not only did he say he was innocent, but he had evidence that the victim had admitted that she lied and had admitted that on video. So he came to us with this information. We launched an investigation into it, and just every corner we turned, we just kept finding more evidence of innocence. Contacted the DA's office. They went in on the investigation with us, and together we were able to get his conviction reversed.
DNA play a role in that?
Not in the exoneration. It did not. Mm-hmm. There was some DNA testing done at the time of trial. It was an alleged rape where she said that there would have been semen, and there was DNA testing done at the time, and none was ever found. But regardless, because the prosecution had charged him with a lot of different crimes, he was facing a life sentence, and so he ended up taking a plea deal just to avoid that, even though he was innocent.
And this is California with the three strikes law. You can't afford a third strike.
Yeah. Well, he had no strikes. You know, he was a high school kid, but he was facing 40-some years in prison. And his lawyer said, you know, we can go in there and roll the dice and go to trial, but she's going to come in and say you raped her and that you kidnapped her. And so he's sitting there, a 17-year-old kid, having to make the decision between going to trial and risking 40-some years in prison or taking a deal that could lead possibly to probation, but in worst-case scenario, a couple of years in prison. So he took that deal and actually went to prison for 5 years. Wow. But when he got out, she Facebook friend requested him, said, can we let bygones be bygones, and admitted that it never happened.
My goodness. It seems to me that beside DNA evidence, which is quite common, results in exoneration, that eyewitness testimony and human testimony is terribly unreliable.
Mm-hmm. It's the leading cause of wrongful conviction. There was a study done of the 2,000 documented cases of wrongful convictions in the United States. And that study had some surprising results. One of them was that bad identifications are the leading cause of wrongful convictions. We also learned that in a high percentage of those cases, snitch testimony was used to get convictions, and that there was a lot of cases where there were actually confessions, but ultimately later on it was discovered that people were innocent. And so we learned that sometimes, you know, people confess to crimes they haven't committed.
Why do you think they do that?
You know, I used to think it was because police were using tactics that were very aggressive to get these confessions. And, you know, quite frankly, I used to be much more cynical about the idea that people did confess to crimes they didn't do. But when you start reading the transcripts of some of these confessions, you see that people just get frustrated with the process. And after several hours, it's not because they're broken down with the baton or the hot light. They just want to get out of the room. So they'll say things like, just give me the paper and I'll sign it. Mm-hmm. And they're thinking, what difference does it make if they sign a confession? Because they didn't do it. And that'll later on be proven out. Next thing you know, maybe there's a bad identification, maybe there's a jailhouse snitch, maybe they don't have an airtight alibi, and they get convicted.
We're talking with Justin Brooks, who's director of the California Innocence Project, and we're also talking with Alyssa Biracle, who is a staff attorney with the project. They were in town last week to talk at Cal Poly, and they're on a walking trip from San Diego to Sacramento. I got to ask you about that walking trip. Why?
Well, it's a crazy idea I had about a year ago. It's, you know, we win a lot of cases. We get a lot of people home. But there's a lot of cases we don't win. And we never give up a case. Because if we believe someone's innocent, we will keep fighting for them year in, year out, in as many venues as we can. And the governor has clemency power. He can fix these cases if he chooses to do so. But clemency is often used for wealthy or well-connected people. Our clients are poor. People don't know about their cases. So I decided that I was going to walk from San Diego to Sacramento and carry the petitions with me on thumb drives and deliver them personally to the governor. And Alyssa Bierkall and Mike Samanchik, two of my staff attorneys, as soon as I mentioned it to them, they said, yeah, let's do it. We'll all do it together. So we've been walking now for 26 days, is it, Alyssa?
It's 26.
This is our 26th day walking from San Diego. And it's been difficult. We've been walking on highways, dodging traffic. We've had to weave our way up the coast in places where it's almost impossible to walk. But we've been raising awareness and doing shows like this one to talk to the public about this issue. We have 12 cases that we've identified where there's compelling evidence of innocence. In fact, in a couple of these cases, judges have found these people innocent, and yet they're still sitting in prison on technicalities. And I think that's something the public doesn't realize, that you can actually be found innocent and still be in prison on procedural reasons, like not filing your paperwork on time.
Oh, yeah.
And it's pretty shocking that in a system that, first of all, is overcrowded and expensive, that we would have any interest in keeping innocent people in prison just to uphold procedures. So the governor's looking at decreasing the population, and what we want to say to him is, why don't we start with the innocent people? Why don't we get them out of prison? And that's what this is all about.
Characterize some of the cases that you're bringing to the governor. Give me some example of what he needs to take action on.
Well, one case, for example, is a guy named William Richards. He was convicted after multiple trials of beating his wife to death. They tried him, multiple juries hung, and ultimately they got a conviction based on almost no evidence. He was the person who came home and found his wife beaten to death so they could put him on the scene at his house. We took the case on a decade ago. We came up with DNA evidence that proves another person was on that crime scene. The DNA evidence was on the murder weapon. There's DNA under the victim's fingernails. That is not our client, is not hers. There's a lot of evidence that we put forth, and we presented it in front of a tough-on-crime former prosecutor judge in San Bernardino County. And it is not easy to win a case out there ever. And this judge declared our client innocent 5 years ago. He's been sitting in prison while the DA has appealed this case all the way up to the California Supreme Court. And last year, in a 4-3 decision, the California Supreme Court decided that we shouldn't have been allowed to present certain expert testimony. And therefore, he's staying in prison for the rest of his life. Mm. Had nothing to do with whether this guy was an innocent man. There's compelling evidence that he's innocent, and he's sitting in prison. And on top of that, he's struggling with cancer, and we spent half our time litigating for his medical care and the other half of the time litigating to get him out of prison.
I guess I know the answer to this, but I'll ask you anyway. Why would a DA dig in his heels so much on a case like this?
I think it's just simple human nature that we work hard on things. We want to believe we've done the right thing. It's hard for us to believe we've made mistakes. And in our daily lives, it's hard to believe we make simple mistakes. Mm-hmm. Now imagine you've made a mistake in a case you've worked on for years, and you've put someone in prison for life as a result of that. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times district attorneys cling to these convictions and fight us on them.
Well, we're talking with two representatives of the California Innocence Project. It's director Justin Brooks and Alyssa Bierkall, who is a staff attorney with the Innocence Project. Is our judicial system just simply flawed? If you were to recreate a judicial system, would you do it differently?
Every judicial system on the planet is flawed in the sense of you can't create a perfect one because there's going to be some level of human error. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, identification problems are human beings' problems with memory and how they do identifications. Now, we can improve those processes by doing better identification procedures. Every procedure could be improved to some level. We could give more resources for investigating cases. That's our biggest problem that we see, is that lawyers haven't fully investigated the facts of a case, and they get pushed through the system because the reality is most people are guilty. And when most people are guilty, the system kind of reacts to the guilty and is set up for the guilty. And the innocent is more an exception. And prosecutors treat it like that, and defense attorneys sometimes treat it like that. So it's very, very difficult when you're an innocent person. You're put into a system that's kind of pushing you through as a guilty person.
Is there any one aspect of the system in California that could be changed to make a difference?
Tomorrow we could change identification procedures. Simple things like the investigating officer who knows who the suspect is should not be in the room when an ID is done. Poker players are the best people in our society at hiding what they think. And still they wear hats, they wear scarves, they wear mirror glasses, they try not to talk when they're playing poker. Police officers are not great poker players, and they often indicate who the suspect is during the procedure. And study after study has shown this. And just by simply excluding those officers from those procedures, we could improve IDs. So there's a lot of simple things like that.
Give me another example. That's fascinating.
We should be audio taping and videotaping interrogations. I mean, if we're confident—
And we don't?
No, there's no requirement for that. Mm-hmm. And if we're confident that these things are done right, then you'd think you'd want that recorded and documented. You'd want to show it and say, look, we offered him coffee, offered him tea, and he gave a confession.
So you're going to the governor. You'll be at the governor's doorstep in a few weeks if your feet hold out on the process. What are the likelihood that he's going to go and say, let's throw these guys out of prison?
Alyssa, Mike, and I firmly believe that when the governor and his staff review these cases, that these individuals are going to be released. There's no way we can motivate ourselves to walk the hundreds of miles. It's actually going to end up being more than 700 miles from San Diego to Sacramento if we didn't believe that.
Sounds fantastic. Now, if people want to find out more about the Innocence Project and maybe even make a contribution to the Innocence Project, how can they do that?
That would be great. Well, our website for the California Innocence Project is CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org. They could also go to InnocenceMarch.com and see everything we're doing with this march. And we would love any donations. We could certainly use some lunch money for Subway, which we stop in every day to eat. We could use – we're sleeping in an RV. We are public interest lawyers, and we raise all the money for these cases. So any donations would be greatly appreciated.
It's a fascinating activity that you're involved in. It sounds to me like you're doing good. And I want to thank you very much for stopping by here. We've been talking with Justin Brooks, who's head of the California Western Law, or he's from the California Western Law School, and he's head of the California Innocence Project, and Alyssa Barrickle, who is a staff attorney. Both of you, thank you very much for coming by.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm your host, Larry Rutter. Coming up, if you're a fan of murder mysteries, as I am, you'll want to learn more about the next offering at the Pewter Plow Playhouse.
This play is one of those murder mysteries that keep people guessing from start to finish, and every time they think they've got it figured out, it's like, what? Oh, my gosh. Right down to the very last word of the show.
And then I think you'll get a chance to learn how the world of news and journalism and how it's taught in places like Cal Poly is adjusting to the brave new world of instant online media.
I've been doing a little bit of research about where the jobs have gone and how many jobs have been lost in the newspaper business particularly, which is the part of the business that's been near and dear to my heart. And we can estimate, and there's no way to know for sure, that about 20,000 jobs have been lost in the last few years.
Wow.
Newspaper companies, that's a lot.
But first, let's peer into the future. Several months ago, we had occasion to visit with our next guest about what I thought was a fascinating approach to looking at the future of a city, in this case, the city of San Luis Obispo, and ultimately updating that city's master plan for the year 2035. Well, to simplify matters, the approach up until the time we talked several months ago was one of gathering as many ideas, feelings, and concerns about the future from as many citizens as possible who chose to be part of the process. And I'm talking about ideas of how the land of the city is used and how people get around the city. Part of the process took place last December, and it was called Future Fair. Well, this Saturday, we're going to have Future Fair 2. So we invited our guest of a few months ago, Kim Murray, who is Deputy Director of Long-Range Planning for the City of San Luis Obispo, to come back and give us a preview of Future Fair 2. Welcome back, Kim.
Thank you, Larry. I'm glad to be here.
Now, is this just a continuation of the process of gathering citizen ideas, needs, and concerns that I know was part of Future Fair 1? Is this just a continuation of that process, or is this a new phase?
This is a new phase. We're calling it Part 2, if you will, because it builds off of the Future Fair, the information that we gathered in December. But it's really, we're getting to the point where we want to refine some of those ideas. So I think of it as like a funnel. We've gathered all these ideas, we're starting to look at them more closely, and we really want our residents and our community members to come forward and say, okay, of these three ideas for this area, which one seems to be have the most merit, just seems to be resonating with the community, so that we know which ones we want to study further as we go further into this process.
So this is a winnowing.
This is a winnowing. That's a great way of putting it.
And from what mass of ideas are these winnowed from? You must have, if there were 100 people, you had probably 99 different ideas, and you had many more than 100.
We had, yes, we've had lots and lots of ideas, but we do find common themes. Great support for open space, great support for bike paths, bike trails, completing existing plans, looking forward and finding different ways of moving around the community. So we do find some commonality in the ideas. What we're looking for at this next workshop is some of the physical improvements that people have identified. So when we hear that people want to find an easier way to move across parts of town, now we're looking at how would we do that? Is it a trail? Is it roundabouts? Is it signals? Is it different land uses? So we're trying to take those ideas and actually assign what would that look like on the ground.
Give me an example of that specific sort of problem that you're approaching.
Some of them aren't problems. Some of them are actually opportunities. So, for instance, if there's the school district has a property that's on Los Osos Valley Road that they're looking forward in the future, they won't need for a school any longer. So they're asking for some community help envisioning what should happen there. Should it be more retail? Should it be more residences? Should it be a mix of residences and a park? So they want those ideas, those physical ideas for what should happen on that corner.
Now, this Future Fair 2, which is a Saturday afternoon,
yes,
at the community room of the Slo Library.
Right. From 1 to 5, we'll probably have, it's a drop-in sort of thing, so you can come and participate at the tables. And around 4:30, we're going to have a reporting out of here's what we heard from everybody. So we'll have probably about 6 different stations. They'll each have a display of that portion of the city that station is going to be addressing. And it will have the various sites that we're looking for input on. This, for example, the one site that I was just referring to will be the Los Osos Valley Road area. So it will not only address, hey, this school site, we're looking for some ideas, but also this intersection seems to be problematic, or this neighborhood seems to have some constraints in how they can get in and out of their neighborhood. And we'll be displaying different alternatives and having people kind of tell us which one they think would work best.
So there'll be 6 different breakouts, I guess. Now, you've mentioned the Los Osos Valley Road, Madonna Road, Foothill, that corridor. What are the other 5?
Oh, boy, you're going to test my memory here. So we have a section that's, again, Los Osos Valley Road and kind of that intersection with Los Osos Valley Road and Higuera will be one area, and also taking into account Madonna. The next area will be around Prado Road and where it intersects the freeway onto the other side of the freeway where that agricultural property is was the subject of Delidio development plan. So that area will be one. We'll have one that takes into account the downtown area. There's a couple of different ideas that we're looking at in terms of the development around the Mission and whether or not there might be some possible either street closures or maybe ability to close off for certain events. There's another area that's up near Cal Poly for some sites there that are we're looking at as potential redevelopment sites. And there is the area along Broad Street where people have expressed a need to be able to get across Broad Street in a little bit easier manner.
Tell me about it. I did that with my dog today. Took my life in my own hands.
There are some of those areas. And some of it is actually asking the question of, we have this in our current plan. Do we still need to carry this forward into the future? So we'll be showing those alternatives and saying, tell us what you think about these.
And let's just take the downtown area for instance, everybody sort of focuses on that, no matter what area they sort of live in. What do you see of as some of the alternative things that might happen to downtown, especially ones that might be controversial?
Well, what we've heard from most of our people who've shown up at the workshops and even through the online tool is that we love our creek and we love to have it be more open. So some residents have suggested ideas for making this creek walk be more open and more continuous. So there are certain areas where you can get to the creek and walk along it in the downtown, but there are other areas where it just kind of disappears behind buildings. And so there's been some input as to how about if we open it up a little bit more.
The elephant in the room, of course, is Cal Poly. Is that at all a consideration in the planning process? What's going to happen on campus? Is the campus going to expand? Can it expand? That sort of thing.
We do coordinate with Cal Poly because obviously they have a master plan that deals with how they want to grow both physically and in enrollment. One of the things we look at is where their development of housing on campus really does have an impact on the city, because right now student populations are renting housing. If there have more of the students that are actually living on campus, that does free up housing within the city for other people to live here. So there's definitely a connection. So far, we haven't heard that they want to expand into the city. You know, obviously they would be looking to build on their own holdings, but there is close collaboration between the city and the Cal Poly.
We're talking with Kim Murray. She's Deputy Director of Long Range Planning for the City of San Luis Obispo, and this is part of the long range planning process that eventually will actually end up in a document, I suppose. What's your time frame?
Our time frame is we will be having some drafts with some proposed changes this fall to look at. So by probably a year from now, we'll have a draft that we can submit to the state, because this all was funded through a state grant, and our deadline is next May. Mm-hmm. So now, we need to have a draft by then.
Does it have to be approved by the city council?
It does not have to be approved by then, but we are looking to get it approved probably in the fall of 2014.
A year and a half from now.
Yes.
And then if whatever is approved will become the planning document, I guess, for land use, for circulation, for traffic and bicycles and cars and all that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
At the end of the process. What do you think is going to be the most politically difficult part of trying to envision the city of 2035?
I think the most difficult piece of this process is finding the words that reflect the vision of the community, because our general plan, our land use element, our circulation element are highly valued by the community and by our decision makers. They're referred to all the time. And so they provide the vision that guides the decision-making process for projects. And so it's a very powerful document. And I think that the biggest challenge going through the process will be making sure that the policy direction, the words and the policy direction really reflect the intent. Because a lot of times the intent is there, but somehow the words don't convey it in a way that is maybe agreed to by everyone. So that piece of the wordsmithing will be challenging in my mind.
So this event takes taking place on Saturday is going to say a lot about the future. And yes, people should, if they care about the future of the city, ought to participate in it. So let's give them all the details they need to participate in this process if they want to.
Yes, absolutely. We want everyone to show up. It's Saturday, June 1st, 1 to 5 at the City County Library. We do have a website, www.slow2035.com. It's where you can find the information about this workshop, about the past workshop, and about all of the hearings that have gone on and task force meetings that have gone on to date. We have lots of material out there.
And you made the point earlier that you don't have to stay for the whole thing, but toward the end, I guess, is going to be the icing on the cake in terms of trying to summarize what you've heard.
Right.
And that'd be what time?
About 4:30.
4:30.
We'll be reporting out.
All right. Kim Murray of the City of San Luis Obispo, Deputy Director of Long Range Planning. I want to thank you very much for joining us and best of luck on Saturday.
Thank you so much.
This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Larry Rutter. In a minute, a whodunit worth watching. And then my conversation about the future of news, news media, and journalism with Mary Glick, head of Cal Poly's Journalism Department. Underwriting support for KCBX comes from Chaz Smit, the Dutch window cleaning artist, offering window cleaning services to both commercial and residential customers. Complete information at DutchWindowCleaningArtist.com. A new play opens this weekend at the Pewter Plow Playhouse in Cambria. The play is called Audience with Murder. It's written by Roger Leach and Colin Wakefield. What caught my interest in the play is what I thought was a very curious review of the play when it appeared at the Edinburgh Festival in Scotland. The review said, "A chameleon of a thriller, packed to the gunnels with guile, chutzpah, and humor. One sentence with five metaphors." Boy, I thought that was really good. So I called the director, Sandy Bosworth, and she's on the line with me now. Good afternoon, Sandy.
Good afternoon.
The play opens on Friday, and there are a lot of murder mystery plays, but why did you select this one? What's special about this play?
This play is one of those murder mysteries that keep people guessing from start to finish, and every time they think they've got it figured out, it's like, what? Oh, my gosh. Right down to the very last word of the show.
Huh. What's the setting for the play? I mean, what's the kind of...
The setting is just the living room of a playwright's house, and the cast is seen at the beginning of the show reading a script that the playwright has written, and it devolves from there.
So is it contemporary?
Temporary or not. It devolves as far as the characters' relationships go. Oh. It made our cast laugh yesterday when we were thinking about it, and we said, gee, it's almost like a game of Clue. We've got a rope, we've got poison, we've got a knife, we've got a gun. We do not have to lead pipe and candlestick, but a lot of various things occur, and I love it. It's just a constant surprise, and that was what caught my attention when I first read the script. And
have you seen it performed before?
I have never seen it performed. It played in London, and it opened, as you said, in Edinburgh. It played in London. It did a run in New York, and I'm an aficionado of murder mysteries myself and thrillers, so I was browsing for some and read this script and laughed and said, this is so much fun. And my cast goes, it's so much fun. I love this show. And I can't imagine that the audience won't walk out going, oh, my gosh.
Are there any particular challenges in putting this on?
There are definite challenges for the cast because without giving too much away, they have various names and characters, even though it's a poor person show. But I don't want to go any further than that because everything I divulge starts to spoil the surprises of the show.
Absolutely. Would you compare this with any other classic murder mysteries? I'm thinking of Sleuth.
I would say that this is possibly, on one sense, a farce of many murder mysteries. Oh. And it blatantly knows it is. So you see a lot of familiarities with a lot of things. And it also, you'll notice in two of the characters that they somewhat channel George and Martha in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. So it's As far as their relationship, definitely. In fact, one of them is even named George.
And your cast, there's four people in the cast, and who are they?
Four people in the cast, Tony Young, Sharon Young, Tracy Mayfield, and Craig Brook.
Oh, and they've all done other stuff.
They've all done shows at the Plow before.
Uh-huh. And you have as well. What was the last?
I have as well.
What was the last thing you directed?
The last thing I directed, the last two last season, one was a thriller, Wait Until Dark, and one was Six Dance Lessons in 6 Weeks. And what I really liked about this was nobody's heard of it.
Yes,
which
that's
is really
right.
Nice because so many things get done three times around here, and you're like, oh, I thought there was anything new.
Well, one of the things that I've always found puzzling about community theater, I guess, and others, is that they do the same plays over and over again.
I know, and I really try not to. I really don't like to, and I really don't like to ever do anything twice because I love the challenge to myself. So when I find something that looks like it's going to be fun for the cast, fun for the audience, and fun for me, which this one has been, I'm attracted to it.
Well, Sandy Bosworth, tell us the details. It opens, you have a preview performance on Friday night, is that right?
Yes, we do. May 31st is the preview performance at 7:30, and then Saturday night is the champagne opening, and there will be a Sunday matinee every Sunday. It runs May 31st through the end of June, June 30th.
And
it's only running 5 weeks, which is short for the Pewter Plow. So if you're going to catch it, plan for only 5 weeks.
And is there a way to get tickets ahead of time?
Yes.
If there is,
you can call
tell
the Playhouse. Phone number 927-3877.
Mm-hmm.
All performances are at 7:30. The matinees are at 3.
Well, as they say in your business, break a leg, Sandy Bosworth.
Thank you.
It sounds like
our characters just might.
Oh, gave it away. The play is Audience with Murder. It opens for a preview this Friday at the Pewter Plow Playhouse in Cambria. And Sandy Bosworth, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm your host, Larry Rutter. One of the most turbulent fields of endeavor today is just about any form of what we might think of as legacy mass media, radio, television, newspapers, magazines. And among the professions that serve this mass media, journalism may be the most turbulent. So the question I'm interested in today is, what does all this turbulence mean for journalism, journalists, and the teaching of journalism? So I've invited into the studio the chair of the journalism department at Cal Poly to talk about it. She's Professor Mary Glick, and she's been the chair since last September after a very extensive career in journalism and marketing, and both in writing, teaching, and in a management capacity. Welcome, Professor Glick.
Thank you, Larry.
Are you troubled by what's happening in journalism today and the work of journalists?
I don't think I would characterize myself as troubled. In fact, I often tell the story that happened to me several years ago when I was running a seminar for executives in the newspaper business. And I had an opportunity to go to a conference in New York called We Media, W-E Media. And it was about the idea of opening up the media where the audience could play an active role, not just as a listener or a receiver or a reader, but be involved and engaged in the production and sharing and commenting about news. And on the eve of that trip, I had contacted an editor, a friend of mine, who was an editor of a rather large newspaper in the United States. And he had written back to me talking about how there was a time in his newsroom where he'd never been so depressed. And he had spent his whole career as a newspaper editor and had been editor of the year previously. So he was quite well-known, quite respected, and quite accomplished. He said he had never been so depressed and never seen his newsroom so depressed. And I wrote back to him and I said, you know, I'm about to attend a conference where I think there are going to be people who are so excited about the future of journalism that the last thing they are is depressed. So I think it really is where you sit that makes it either an exciting time or a depressing time. And I would not put myself in the troubled or depressed category.
Where do people sit that are excited about journalism today?
I think the people who are excited about journalism see the opportunities and see the idea that it's no longer controlled tightly by a small group of people who through the decades have been trained and professionalized to speak and write for the general audience. It's more about the people who see the opportunity that technology brings to open up the media, have more people be engaged as producers, as content producers, as sharers of information, as people who are engaged in the conversation about what's going on in the world around them. Mm-hmm. Those are the people, I think, who don't necessarily come from traditional media organizations, although there are certainly people in traditional media organizations who are excited about the future and the possibilities as well.
Some have complained about the loss of sort of some of the basic values of journalism. And we saw a lot of this criticism come up in the coverage of the bombings in Boston, where not only websites and tweets and all that kind of Twitter were getting it wrong, but you had people like CNN come under a lot of criticism. And a lot of the criticism might have to do with the lack of some of the basic values of journalism, which is getting it right. Getting it first is important if you're competitive, but getting it right and getting it completely. And doesn't it trouble you that that's being lost in the flow today?
I don't think we may be in an era when many different voices can be heard in this media ecosystem that exists out there. Not all of them trained as journalists, not all of them with a professional attitude. And it is disturbing in any moment in time when people who are professionals, who work for the media organizations that we have come to trust over the years, do journalism in a way that doesn't do anyone proud. And I watch some of that coverage, and I share the dismay that people have of some of the ways things were covered. I don't think we may be in a unique time in that fact that it's so widespread, that so many people can be part of the conversation. But I don't think we're in a unique time where journalists are struggling with how to use the tools available to them. And we just need to learn. And that's one of the reasons I've been talking to the faculty and a great group of people that I work with at Cal Poly about the need to teach those skills from the very get-go. It's not just about writing the story for the next day's paper when you have several hours to be able to track down your sources and write your story and have it edited and vetted. But we need to be teaching students right now how to tell that story in the first 30 seconds. We need to be teaching students right now how to tell that story in the first 30 minutes and throughout the day as it's evolving. And we need to teach them how to apply the rules that we've come to trust and rely on to assure that we're doing an accurate and fair reporting job so we can be a trusted commodity in the future.
Does that reflect that kind of need reflect in the curriculum, for instance?
We're definitely going in that direction.
Give me an example.
Well, we are putting together a new media organization, a student media organization on campus, which will launch in the fall. And it started out as the idea of being a converged media organization, which really may have meant broadcast technology and print technology and having students be multimedia journalists. But it's a little bit more than that these days, and we're calling it digital first. It's not a term we invented. It's out there. It's really turning the whole thing upside down, where the first thing that's on your mind is what are the digital tools available to you? What are the social tools available to you? What are the multimedia tools available to you that you can start to tell the story in what they call in real time as it's happening? And those are complex skills.
Yes.
Not just the thing, you know, you can go into the job of being a journalist with a higher level of critical thinking, a higher level of understanding the ramifications of what you do, a higher level of, well, certainly technology. You have to be more adept at a whole variety of tools out there. So it's becoming a really sophisticated profession, and I think we should not doubt that it is a sophisticated profession and getting more so. And the students we train have got to be top-notch and have got to really understand that they have huge responsibility in the media mix out there.
It used to be if you could write an inverted pyramid, clear sentences, you were halfway there. Seems to me that you have to have skills that are unheard of. You have to be able to look at a camera sometimes and talk your story off the top of your head.
Right, exactly. The skills that broadcast journalists have had to develop for decades now are also becoming the tools and skills that traditional print journalists are adopting. And so students need to be adept at telling the story however it needs to be told. Mm-hmm. And it's been reflected in curriculum changes that have been made over the past year or so, where universities are recognizing that the traditional way we have taught journalism, which is really a small sort of one-third of a liberal arts education where you learn some of the professional tools, they've loosened up a little bit and allow students to take more units in journalism. This is all inside baseball talk from the curriculum standpoint, but we're recognizing that students need more time with the tools as well as with the understanding of how the world works, which is what a liberal arts education will bring them. So it's expanding. People are recognizing that there's a lot more to it these days.
Is there an expanding market for sophisticatedly trained journalists today?
Oh, you bet. There's no doubt in my mind. And it may not be in the usual places. I've been doing a little bit of research about where the jobs have gone and how many jobs have been lost in the newspaper business particularly, which is the part of the business that's been near to my heart. And we can estimate, and well, there's no way to know for sure, that about 20,000 jobs have been lost in the last few years.
Wow.
On newspaper companies. That's a lot. And we're looking at training a whole bunch of more journalists. What, you know, people are saying, why? What's this all about? Mm-hmm. Well, if you look at where the hiring is taking place, it's not necessarily taking place at those traditional media companies, although they are starting to hire again. You're looking at the non-traditional companies that are hiring journalists. You hear the term corporate reporter. You hear the term brand journalist. And that has to do with the whole idea that I have, which is that every company is a media company. Now every company has the ability and the obligation to talk directly to its constituencies. And I talk about company, I'm talking about every organization you can think of, every nonprofit, every hospital, every university. I mean, and we need professional communicators to do these jobs. They are not the traditional PR or public relations jobs as they have been thought of in the past. You don't need to go through the intermediary of having an editor or a reporter think you've got a good story idea to tell the story in their newspaper or on their TV show. You go directly to the people you want to communicate with. And you can do this in an educational way. You can do this in an informative way, not spin, but real, honest, straightforward communication. And the more sophisticated companies are adopting this. You will find employment for people as independents. I don't think this is a huge market, but there is certainly enough evidence that people have gone into business for themselves, created their own quote-unquote brands around their journalistic abilities. You have partnerships between community foundations and people who know how to use the media to create new community-oriented news and information providers that are highly competitive with the traditional newspapers and broadcast operations that have been flourishing in communities. This is a time, this, you know, we've talked about this being the information age. You probably heard that term 30 years ago.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Well,
way in my youth.
Here it is. I mean, we are experiencing it. Uh-huh. And we find students coming in with storytelling abilities and interests. This is what they do. This is how they communicate with one another. You know, and they expect to be able to do this. And I think there's great opportunities for them out there.
We're talking with Mary Glick. She is chair of the journalism department at Cal Poly. And we invited her in because we were curious about how the media is going and where journalists are fitting in the future. There are some aspects of information sharing, let's call it journalism, that trouble me today. And one is being paid per page view, which is fairly common in, well, like Gawker Media, for instance, comes to my mind. But there are others that are the same way. Does that trouble you? And is that something that you have to consider in your journalist education?
I think we have to look at the business aspects of the business of journalism. Do I think that people should be paid per page view? No. And in fact, I remember reading where this was first proposed back in some South American country in, about 2002, I was looking into this. So I don't think that's necessarily the way we need to go. However, I think journalists need to be aware of the impact that they can have on an audience, and that should be part of what they're thinking of. It's hard to quantify because people want to go to the extreme and say, we know we're going to be selling our souls by giving people, you know, all the fluff and the celebrity news that, you know, drives profits. And I don't think you need to go to the extreme to be able to say, I want to serve an audience with a need to know, and I want to provide information that's relevant to them. So I think there's a little bit of, I don't want to say, I've also heard of people say about spinach journalism, you know, it's as good for you. You don't like the taste of it, but you better eat it because you really need to know this stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's been my experience that people will select the news that they are interested in reading. And I was just talking to a recent acquaintance of mine who had spent years in journalism and journalism education, talking about the most phone calls she ever got as a newspaper editor was the day they left Dear Abby out of the newspaper. And I just nodded because I had had that same experience as a newspaper lifestyle editor. Most people don't call if you haven't covered the sewer board or you haven't covered the latest, well, may they make call you about the latest city council if it's an issue they're interested in. But people, you know, let's don't fool ourselves. They may have been glancing at the headlines, but they were not reading your stories from the first word to the last about the water board necessarily. They were reading the comics and they were reading Dear Abby and they were going to the recipes and all of those things that made a newspaper valuable to people had to do with what they were interested in. Now, am I advocating that journalists should renege on that responsibility? No. I think that there's room for all of it, and I think that journalists need to be doing their work in a way that reaches an audience, is really about relevance and making the story compelling. Part of the obligation of a good storyteller is to tell the story in a way that makes it readable, makes it something that the audience wants to participate in, wants to be able to consume. And so, you know, we may have gotten a little lazy in our journalism in the fact that we had a kind of an arrogance about, I'm covering the important issues of the day and, these need to be covered in a way, whether it's interesting or not, you know, this kind of spinach journalism idea out there that it's good for you and we're going to tell you whether you want to know about it or not. So I think there are many ways to approach journalism. I think that we have to look at the whole scope of it. And I think we also need to be aware that storytelling is part of it, storytelling that's compelling is part of it, and finding a way to touch people with the news that's important for them to know. So I think it's more of a burden today to be able to reach that audience. You can't just tell the story in a kind of way that doesn't take into account how people are going to interact with that story.
I want to take you back to something you said a few moments ago, and I can't remember the words you talked about, but you were talking about curriculum, and you were talking about journalist educational experiences which were multimedia, that weren't just print or whatnot. Can you describe what you have in mind for that and use the words that you used before that have slipped my mind?
Well, I think maybe you were looking for the word digital first, which
yes.
is how I described it.
Yes.
It's really, this is going to be an evolution that will happen as we're launching this new media organization on campus, where students will be learning how to use the tools available to them to understand storytelling from a perspective of we need to tell the story while it's happening, as well as wrap it up and analyze it after the fact. We need to do more storytelling in advance of things that we know are coming up. Let's face it, not everything we're covering in a student organization particularly, and in many community organizations, news organizations, is breaking news. Some of it we know well in advance is going to be happening. The council meeting's coming up. We know what's going to happen. A concert's going to happen. A guest is coming into town. We know these things in advance. So instead of reporting about them after the fact and thinking that we've done our duty, we need to be reporting about them upcoming so that people can participate and engage. And we need to report them as they're happening so people can, if they can't be there in person, can participate in some vicarious way, virtual way. And we need to wrap up and tell our usual story after the fact. So, mm-hmm. you know, and I think that requires discernment of what's important in people's lives that we need to be covering.
When the bombing took place with the marathon in Boston, one of the serious complaints about people like CNN, for instance, was what constitutes reliable information and what is gossip and how do you frame that? And it seems to me it's different today than it was because of the pull of time limitations. Is there something in the education process that comes to grips with that today?
I don't think we throw out the kinds of core, important dedication to getting the story right that has been, you know, at the very basic level of teaching journalism for the last several decades. And I think it's even more important now than ever that we emphasize that, that we understand there are great pressures in this cover the story before it happens, cover the story as it happens, cover the story after it happened. Mm-hmm. Great pressure to be out there in this immediate news world that we live in and understand how to use restraint. How to use discernment, how to use basic understanding of we cannot just be spreading rumors out there. We have a responsibility. People will look to us for accuracy and the complete story. It's hard to tell the complete story in 140 characters in a tweet, but it's not impossible to tell what you know and the facts and lead people to the larger story. We've distilled the news lead down to 25 words. I mean, that's what I was taught when I was learning to write my inverted pyramid news stories years ago. Now we're telling it in a slightly more contracted format, and we're telling it more quickly. You cannot deny that those things are out there. I think it's even more important now than it ever was to tell students that spreading rumors without verifying, all the kind of fact-checking and verification that's been part of journalism needs to be there, and even more so.
In local journalism, hear a lot of complaints about local events and local government activities, local things that have great impact but not a lot of sex appeal, is being neglected today because of the power of the financial pressures on the press. You agree with that? What do we do about it?
Yes, I do agree with that. I think that local news organizations have been asked to cut back because of the demands of profits from, in many cases, corporate entities that live far from where the community is that's being served. That's nothing new, and companies are surviving in a world where, you know, their revenue's been ripped out from under them. Think about what Craigslist did to the whole classified advertising business.
Absolutely amazing. Most people had no idea how important that was to the financial structure of newspapers.
Right. I have estimates of about a third of the revenues coming into newspapers were from the classified advertising that was running them.
Essentially
it's gone.
Gone.
Completely gone. So there's you have to sort of understand what's happened to these companies and why they're responding the way they are. And I think we're starting to find things kind of where they're coming to a bottoming out place, where I hope we may be seeing some organizations realize that they cannot be cutting anymore and do their jobs responsibly. But I think you have to look at the larger what's called ecosystem of news, where we can't necessarily just rely on one local newspaper a daily, one local newspaper a weekly, one local radio station, and one TV station. There's many players in the mix now, as I talked about before. We've got nonprofit or community organizations hiring journalists to do storytelling in depth about particular issues and to cover the community in depth. You've got bloggers out there who've been struggling to make a living on their own, but it can be done, and it has been done, and you may not get rich quick, but we're still seeing these experiments, and we're still in an experimental age where people with civic interests have come forward to cover things locally that are no longer being covered by the traditional news organizations because they simply don't have the staff to do it. So the ecosystem has enlarged. Many more people are in the mix. It's kind of like we used to listen to Uncle Walter on CBS every evening. And when there were three broadcast news organizations running a 30-minute newscast in the evening, well, look at how that's changed. Many more players in the mix now. I think we're seeing that same kind of expansion going on. And a lot of people stepping up. A lot of the people who regularly follow local issues are suddenly empowered to have a voice that reaches far more people because of the technology available to them. And they're starting to get more sophisticated about how to use it. So, yes, there's a time, I think, where we're looking at traditional organizations and saying, you're not giving us what you used to and what we need. And they're really trying hard. I know them. I know the people who work for these organizations. I've met them through the years. They're dedicated. They're committed. They want their communities to not only survive but thrive. They want to be able to give the people the information that they need to be able to make informed choices. They're all out there working very hard. The constraints of the finances are there. They're short-staffed, and they're doing the best they can. But there are other people sort of coming in to fill in those gaps, and it's yet to be seen how that's all going to play out. But isn't it an exciting time, Larry, to be living, watching this all happening
it
before
is.
Our very eyes?
And also not to have a personal stake in it, in the outcome. Mary Glick, who is the chair of the journalism department at Cal Poly, has been our guest, and it's been fascinating. I wish we had more time. We don't, but we'll come back and we'll talk about it sometime in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Larry Rutter.